Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, again, we're going to start up. This was supposed to be a youth session, right?
We never announced it as a youth session. Everybody can thank you.
This is youth at heart session. Okay. All right. I guess we'll start from where we left off, you know, so that I can explain some of the things that are necessary for how ijtihad works and how a person becomes mujtahid. So, you see, the knowledge of Islam came from the Quran and Hadith. Right? When a Hadith is spoken, it's not just the words. You know, when, for example, when you hear a majlis in the alam, if you just hear the words in written, and I've done this many times, for example, you see that a lot of the majlises are written down and they're, you know, handed out like a book, right? So you read the majlis and you see that it's not the same as if you're hearing it. Because when you're hearing it, it's not just the words, it's the expression, the tone, gestures, all of these are also adding to the message. The problem with reading hadith is that you're just reading the words without the tone, without the expression, without the gestures, without any of these things. You're just reading the words. And you're trying to understand from those words what is the meaning of what the Imam wants to say here. So when ijtihad is done, really, the differences is not from the words of the ayat and hadith. The difference is not in the content of the hadith. The difference comes when you try to interpret the tone of the hadith and to see in what tone did the Imam say this in. You know, there are many things you analyze in hadith, you know, to know that exactly what is being said, to come down to the main issue, what is being said. And because of the fact that we need to interpret these hadiths, that's why you see many people reach different conclusions. And because of these different conclusions, you have different opinions amongst mujtahid as to this is wajib, this is mustahab, or if it's haram, or if it's makruh. You know, there is that differences of opinion that come because at the end they are trying to interpret what the Imam said and trying to deduce that to make it into a knowledge, you know, into fiqh. And that's where you get the differences of opinions amongst the mujtahid. Now, when we want to look for a mujtahid, as I was saying, right, we came to the fact that alamiyat, we need to see where the majority of the ulama are going. Who are these ulama that we are going to listen to? That's the issue. Those who are cut off from the house, meaning they live somewhere else and they're doing something else now. Now they're doing tabligh, they're doing, for example, Islamic work outside. You know, this is also a job. For example, what Maulana Hushabir is doing here is a job of organizing a community, of informing people, and anyone here, being a resident alim here, doing tabligh or doing dawah, whatever it is a job also. Not everyone can just be in the house trying to be a mujtahid. Right? So now, those who are outside, they're also doing a job. But those who are outside cannot give testimony as to who is the alam and who is the most knowledgeable. The only people who are qualified to say who amongst us is the most knowledgeable are the people who are in the hawza, the teachers who are in the hawza. Maulana Ali Reza Rizvi was trying to explain about who the Jamiul Mudarrisin are. Jamiul Mudarrisin just means the teachers of the Hauza, those who teach in the Hauza, and amongst them are all the Maraji, you know. For example, Atla Nasir Makarem, Atla Wahid Khurasani, all of these people are in Jamiul Mudarrisin. Right? They are the teachers of the Hauza. And they, from the teachers of the Hauza, which is the faculty of the Hauza, they are the ones who see amongst themselves who amongst us is the most knowledgeable. Now, if there's no one person who's outrightly the most alam or the most knowledgeable, then they'll say, okay, these 5, 6, or 7 people are at that level that you can make taqleed to them. So when they chose those people, now you can choose any one of them you want, and you have a hujjat with Allah that the people who are qualified, they say that these are the ones, and that's why I make taqleed of, for example, Ayatollah Nasir Makarem. Right? And hence, you will be alright with Allah in that sense. Now, the issue is here, and this is in all the mujtahid, and you see that, you know, how you find a mujtahid. They say the majority of the ulama, that they should testify that someone is a mujtahid. And here the issue that happens, that when they said that, the majority of the ulama are in Qum. They're not in Najaf, and they're not in Sham or any other place. They are in Qum. You know, 80% of the ulama are in Qum. Right? And that's the issue now, that the 80% of the ulama are in Qum, they don't know what is the situation of the people in Najaf. And they can't give a testimony also about people who are in Najaf. They can't say that because they won't know. Right? If they were here in Qom, it would be different. Then they would know. But because they're in Najaf or in Sham, they won't be able to give testimony. And the same thing with Najaf. Those who are in Najaf cannot give testimony to the people in Qom because they don't know people in Qom. Right? They might be mujtahid and marja, but they don't know. Right? So how can you give, like for example, if I live in Florida and if I hear about someone in Chicago and I say, you know, yes, he's a great alim. I don't know him. I don't know him. I don't know what he says and so on and so forth. So I can't give a testimony. It would be a false testimony. This is haram in Islam. You just can't give a wrong witness about someone. Why? That's the reason that when you see they give a list of maraji from Qom, right? They will give the maraji who are in Qom because they can testify to them, because they know them, because their classes are there in front of them. So now, because 80% of the ulama are in Qom, that's the reason that, you know, for example, to us, it's easier to take their testimony because they're the majority, and all the maraji said that whoever the majority are giving witness to, you just follow them. So since the majority are giving witness to this list of people, so that's why we choose from that list of people. Now, for the other places, send a salawat. Thank you. So now when we come to like other places, the problem with other places, like in Najaf, right? The amount of ulama that are there, and obviously there is, for example, ijtihad being done there, this and that, but because of the fact that there is a small amount of people there, right? And they will choose the one that they have as the marja, or they think is the marja, they will announce it, that this, the marja in our view, right? Now it's up to us, right, that, for example, since it is said that the way to know alam is when the majority says that this is the alam. So when the majority is in a qawm, then the natural process and the logical thing is to listen to qawm and see that what do Jamiul Mudarrisin say, what is their list, and when they give the list, you just choose the marja from there. This is how the marja is chosen. Now, it doesn't mean that the people in Najaf are wrong. It doesn't mean that. They are just choosing the marja of who they know in Najaf. And they will have their own marja there, because they can't give a testimony of what's happening in Qom. And these two are the main places, are basically the main places. But it will be the teachers in Najaf who will choose the marja there. It will be the teachers in Qom who will choose the marja here. Right? So they are going to say that, you know, like for example, the organization Qom, as you know, is Jamiul Mudarrisin. They will appoint the marja and they say, this is the marja. Right? That's there. Now, when they say this is the marja, so it's like, for example, they are like the bar, and they will give license to the attorneys. Right? The attorneys, whoever wants to practice law, has to take the bar exam, you know, and once they pass that, then they have the license to practice law. And the same thing as Ma Ali Radhavi is saying, right, is practicing medicine. You have to take the board exam. When the board approves you, then you get a license. And here's the issue that comes in, that is happening and will happen, right? Is that whenever, like for example, the bar sees that the attorney is doing malpractice of the law, right? Or a doctor is doing malpractice, then they can revoke the license. Right? They can revoke the license because they're saying, what are you doing? This is not the way it's done. Right? And they at first, you know, will investigate and inquire, see if he's going to change or not. If not, then they're going to disbar him.
Mawlana, I will go back to my question I posed to Mawlana Ali, brother. And that was about Ahle Khubra deciding about the Alim.
Right.
Or Alim. Mm-hmm. And since they see and go to the lectures or speeches of the scholars, they know the people in Iran. So they can say, okay, who is the Alim? And my question was, can they do the same to those who are in Iraq? He was saying there are other ways of doing that. And that's how initially when Ahle Khubra sent out a list, Mawlana Ayatollah Sistani's name was not in there, but that was later added on.
I don't know if it's still added on or not, right? The issue is that, you know, you see that they do not disqualify someone who's not in Qom. Right? They will not do that because of the fact that, you know, there's a process of doing it. It's an Islamic law. Right? There's a process of doing it. When someone, for example, is giving weak fatwas, you know, what we call weak or ba'id or da'if. Rulings that are ba'if in the sense that they don't have strong proofs. So if anyone wants to say, you know, if anyone wants to have an opinion that is strange or that is weak or that is far-fetched, then he has to bring strong proof in his class. Right? In his Kharij class, he has to bring strong proof so that, you know, for example, those people who will challenge his fatwa, right, he's able to defend it and then prove to others that what he's saying is legitimate. Right? And when someone gives weak fatwas and da'if or ba'id fatwas, then when they are questioned and if they don't give the answer, then they have to revoke it because you're not able to prove it. So if you can't prove it, it means it doesn't exist. Right, then it's your opinion. You cannot give your opinion and say that this is the Islamic law. If you say that this is your opinion, then give proof from Islam that it is there. Right? This is the way it works, and that's the way it is. But what happens is this. Those who are outside of the Qum, they're not in the Hawza. They cannot be reached. We have no access to them. You know, like they have no access to them. Even if they give weak fatwas and this and that, they are not able to question them on that. Since they don't question them, they don't even give any opinion about them. But if they were in Qum, right, they would then ask them, you gave this fatwa. You said it's allowed for non-mahram women, like men and women, to shake hands. Right? Where's the proof of that? Where's the proof of that? You know, so he has to prove it in the Hawza. He can't go outside to the people and prove it. I mean, they won't know what to say. They won't know how to defend. They won't know how to investigate, or they won't know how to challenge him. If you want to give a new fatwa, you give it in the Hawza first. Let it be challenged there. And then iron it out to make sure that it is something that is Islamic. Right? So, when, for example, you give weak fatwas, and you see that, the example of, let's say, for example, you have like Ayatollah Fadlullah, you know, who has given, for example, fatwas that, you know, you will see that, like, none of the ulama, they accept or have ever said. So now, because he's not even in the Qum, you know, he's not even Najaf, he's in Sham, right, he's in Lebanon. So no one has access to him. So no one's going to say, okay, you know, if you're doing it there, that's it, you know. I mean, like, you know, if someone's going to follow you, they're on their own. Right? But if you come to the Hawza, then they'll question. Now, when an alim in Iran, like Ayatollah Sani, is doing that, then right away they're going to jump on it. They're going to ask him, where did he cut this from? What's the proof? What's your ijtihad? What's your dalil? What's your burhan? And if he's not able to furnish the burhan, then there's only one choice left. Either you revoke the fatwa and say that, okay, you know, this is not a fatwa, or like, if you want to insist on it, then we have to disqualify you. Right? And hence, he was disqualified from being a marja, that you cannot make taqlid of him. Right? This is what happens. This is the way it works. Right? Because they are the ones who issued the license that, yes, he's a marja, you can follow him. But when they see that he's doing, you know, like this and that, then they have to come, all the mudarrisin, these are all the teachers now. Right? Because, you know, the Hawza maintains the integrity of the learning and the issuing of fatawa according to Islamic Shariat, you know, according to the principles. Right, they have to maintain the integrity, you know. If they don't maintain the integrity, if they let someone do this and they allow it, then they will lose the integrity of the knowledge. Right? You know, the integrity of the knowledge has to be maintained. If someone is not maintaining it, they have to be disqualified. Right? And this is what happens. Right? So, are there any questions on that?
Not on that. I have another question, but if I remember.
Yes.
My question is that in Quran, it's Islam, I think.
Islam.
In Quran, it says Prophet Nuh was in Dawah for 980 years, and then he lived for around 3,000 years. Back in the days, was it everybody living that long, or were the prophets only?
You know, think of that, you know, age in those days, in the earlier days, right? Yes, you know. You see that people had lived longer, you know, I don't know, less air pollution, you know, whatever. whatever the reason it was, right, they lived a little bit longer, right? You see people having 200 years, 300 years, and it's not just him, there are many others, right? We have in history, right, who lived a long time. Even there, you know, there are some people, there was an oracle by the name of Sutay. He lived for 900 years until the birth of the Prophet. He lived until the birth of the Prophet, you know. And he is the one who prophesied the birth of the Prophet before he was born, right, to the people of Mecca, right, and the whole region. And you see this, in history, like many people have lived for long lives, you know. They lived long lives and, you know, Allah, you know, like, whatever reason it was, we don't know the reason why they lived so long, you know. I can't give you any reason for that, you know, but, you know, they did have long lives. You know, not all of them, there are some who died early, some who died late, right? But they had more longer, I mean, the span of life you see in history, in the early history of man, was longer than what it is now. Here you see the average age 60, you know, maybe less than 58, you know. So like the average age, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe like 1,000, 2,000 years ago, right? It was a little bit more than that, you know. But it kept on decreasing, you know. And I think, you know, for many reasons, you know, it can be attributed.
This is related to the oracle you were talking about.
Sutai.
Is it true that people can actually, that there are oracles that can tell the future? For example, I know there's a Buddhist monk.
Before the birth of the prophet, yes.
But not after the birth?
What happened is that the jinn, shaitan, had access to the heavens, meaning the heaven skies, right? Because he was, you know, like for example, they didn't have access to the throne, but they had access to the seven skies, you know? So they could go there and they would see the ordinances and the decrees coming down. The angels used to bring it down, they would see what's coming down, you know? They would have the knowledge of that. And hence, you know, they would then relate it to the people on the earth. Right? The jinn would relate to the people on the earth, and that's where they get the access of knowledge from. Mm. When Prophet Isa was born, right, the top three levels of heaven, right, were barred for all the jinn. You know, for everyone else. You know, so, you know, it was like, you know, authorized personal land only, you know, in the first three levels of the heavens. And this continued till the birth of the Prophet. When he was born, then the rest of the skies were blocked for them. Since the rest of the skies were blocked, and so before that, yes, the access to knowledge from the jinn who used to have the knowledge of what's coming down and the decrees and ordinances that are coming down, they would know that, right? And they would inform their people, you know, on earth. But then what happened is that when the Prophet was born, that's when you see that all of these things were blocked off. And now, after the Prophet, anyone who claims to know this is lying. Right? Yes. This knowledge existed before the birth of the Prophet, and that's why many of the oracles turned against the Prophet and they attempted to kill him. The oracle, from Yemen, she was the queen of Yemen at the time of the birth of the Prophet by the name of Zarqa, the oracle queen of Yemen. She also saw the signs of the birth of the Prophet, you know, when he was conceived, right? And there were signs in the skies. And so she came to Mecca, right? And she met with Hutay to reconfirm, because, you know, he was also well known in the whole region for being an oracle. Hutay was interesting because, he did not have any bones in his body. He only had a skull and a spine. And so, you know, like he would be laid out like a mat, and he would be rolled up into a bag, and then he'll be, you know, carried away. You know? So he came to confirm the birth and said, yeah, yes, he's being born, you know? And everyone who was there, you know, they all believed in him because the kings, the local kings in the area, right, even Iran, they used to take advice from him. Right? He was like their, you know, like their advisor. He was an oracle that they used to take advice from. And he came there, and he reconfirmed it. And she wanted to kill the Prophet, right? So she attempted to kill the mother of the Prophet, Amina, who was pregnant with the Prophet. You know, she hired someone who was the hairdresser of Amina, you know, and the rest of the tribe. She hired her to go with a knife to kill her, but, you know, then something happened that she wasn't able to kill her, and, you know, then the whole plot was uncovered, and that's how, you know, she was saved. So, yes, you know, I mean, yeah, that's about long lives.
that question about youth. You had said that this was supposed to be a youth session, but so I was wanting to ask you, what's your evaluation of why the youth are not here?
The youth are here, right? Well, I see the youth are outside when I was speaking. So now they're here, I guess.
Well, I didn't know about it. I just came into Pridamas and I was like, okay.
You know. But, yeah, I mean, the youth are here. They can listen up. You know, but, so, in terms of ijtihad and taqleed, right, I hope I answered the question, you know, about the differences, you know, of this and that, right? It's because everyone, Najaf has its own institution, Qum has its own institution, and they can only verify what they have, not the other.
For the region, I mean, for Iran, that, and for...
No, because we have two institutions, right? So it's not about Iran or Iraq, it's about institution. Meaning the Hausa in Najaf can only verify what's in Najaf. Meaning,
Master. All of us don't have access to go and see the verification of
meaning. No, but alhamdulillah, you know, that will happen, right? Is that obviously the Hausa in Qum is more organized. Right, they issue the letter every year, right, to all the people to see. You can go online and see it, you know, this and that. You know, they do that, you know, because of the fact that, you know, there's a lot more people there. As you were saying, there are 60,000 students from almost all the countries in the world. You know, so it's like a huge place. And then you're talking about the higher levels of studies, you know, obviously not a lot of people are there. But you see, you know, that over there, you know, they're more organized in that sense, right? Like more so than in Najaf, because Najaf right now, they are just, you know, heading out of the Saddam years and trying to organize now. So hopefully they will also be organized soon.
What if somebody's marjayyat has been announced outside of these two places?
Yeah.
It won't be valid. Right? On what basis are you going to accept it? Because, you see, as I said, you know, we go through the three steps of how you accept. Either you're a mujtahid, that you know that he's the marja, or two mujtahids give testimony if there is no contradicting testimony from someone else, or the majority of the mujtahids, they go and they say that this is the marja. So you have to have either of these three proofs. And none of these three proofs are established from anyone who's not in any of these institutions, either in Najaf or Qum.
No, somebody is from somebody, but he's affiliated in some madrasa, but his marjayyat has been announced from another country.
Whoever is announcing it is trying to testify that he's a marja, right? And you ask them, like, how can that be done? Right, it cannot be done. Right, there's no way for you to say he's a marja when the institution he's in is not saying he's the marja. So if you want to know who the marja in Qum, you go to Jami al-Mudarrisin, they'll tell you who the marja is, and if he's not on the list, then according to Qum, if he's in Qum, he's not a marja. You cannot follow him. You have no proof with Allah now. Right, when you go before Allah on the Day of Judgment, what proof are you going to say? That, you know, I did because, you know, he made everything easy for me? That's not a proof, you know.
If you go back to in India, where Shia was there, Maulana Nasir Millet was, I heard the name, and Baqul Ulum. They were having some, people were following them and they were being accepted as if they were in India, in Lucknow.
Right.
So I know how you will compare with them, because at that time, when there was the, you know, Tabana edition, that time, Maulana Nasir Millet was the father of Sindhi Millet and Awami's grandfather. Mm-hmm. I heard of a guy that he was accepted in Iran.
As a mujtahid. As a mujtahid.
As a marja.
I don't know about a marja, but he was accepted as a mujtahid. That, you know, he has done his ijtihad and he's, you know, and he can give his own opinion.
Yes. So when you are saying, I'm just adding this question, that it was happening over there at the time.
Right.
Why can it happen right now?
No. See, what happened, right, is this, you know. I want to understand this, right? Right. The institutions, right, you know, this is an evolving process.
Right.
From the time of the Imam till now. from, you know, from the time of the Ghaybat until now, it's an evolving process. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not like this is what we were given then and it's still the same thing. It's not the same thing as it was then. It's evolving, right? With more knowledge, with more research, with more in-depth analysis, it's evolving, right? And there's something else. And you see the rules, you know, if you go back 150, 200 years and you see the books of fiqh, right, this is Al-Amiriya, there was no chapter on taqleed. Right? There was no chapter on ijtihad and taqleed, you know? This, you see, the last 80 years, you see, was added, the rules were organized, right? It's an evolving process, you know, whatever the need is, you see the book is growing. If you look at the book of Allama Hilli, of fiqh, yeah. Right, if you look at his book of fiqh, it's 80 pages. Yeah. You know, I mean, 80 pages was the, you know, fiqh book for the Shia world at that time. If you look in our time, right, the book has gone to like 600 pages. You know, 600 pages of rules, you know? So obviously, as you see, that it's evolving, right? And ijtihad is evolving also, right? And the rules on which ijtihad is done is also evolving. And the method of how you see, for example, the mujtahid is chosen, or the known, or the alim is known, is also being defined and also refined over the years. So yes, in those days, it might have been the case, you know, where it was loosely done, but now you see everything is being, you know, consolidated,
organized,
you know, getting it right, you know, so it's evolving into that. Yes, sir?
Can you name again the ulamas who have been recognized by the program?
Meaning, Hamil Mudarrasin, you know, you have Ayatollah Nasir Makarim, Shirazi, Ayatollah Wahid Khorasani, Ayatollah Safi Gulpaygani, Ayatollah Nuri Hamadani, Ayatollah Khamenei. These are ones, maybe there's like some Rouhani also. I don't know, some are there.
And again, I think I was outside, so I don't know if you have wanted to get rid of this question, but you said that, you know, a majority should support that Alim to be qualified for being a Muslim. So, presently, who is supported by a majority?
Well, as I explained, right, the majority is in Qom. More than 80% of the ulama, the mujtahideen, are in Qom. Right, they teach in Qom, they live in Qom. That's where the thing is. And so, you know, it only makes sense that, you know, what Jamil Mudarrasin says is proof before Allah, you know, that Allah, this is the majority, this is where everyone was. They said this, and hence, alhamdulillah, we're doing taqreed because of these people. It's over. You're free with Allah.
Is it because of Iran? Is government, Shia government now free, like the Shah time, but before it was in Mecca?
Yes. And, you know, according to Hadith, it is said that, you know, a day will come when the knowledge is going to go from Najaf to Qom, you know? And I think that's what we saw in our lifetime. In our lifetime, we saw that movement, you know? And because of what happened in Iraq, Najaf, you see, a lot of the ulama and teachers went to Qom to teach there because they were free to teach there, they went there, they taught there, and they raised the students there, and now they live there, and they don't want to move back now. This is their place, you know, they like it, the children are there, their students are there who they taught, and now their students are teachers there in Qom. They, you know, obviously, why would they want to move now? It's over, now they're here, you know. Yeah.
Mona, there's a question from here. The sister side, they're asking, those who do ijtihad, the alims that are practicing, are doing the teaching there and things like that, how do they get paid and do they have a salary and how does that work?
Okay. See, what happened, right, is this. Yes. The hawza is run on khums money. Khums is meant for the imam's work, which is the hawza. Right? In the ghaybat of the imam, that's where khums has to be used. Right? That's the first priority. And when khums, and when there's left over, then you have to spend it on poor people and all these things. But first it has to be spent on the hawza, because that is the work of the imam in the ghaybat of the imam. You know, to teach and to learn, you know, fiqh, you know, and understanding of Islam. Right? That's where it's learned. So, what happened is that, yes, everyone in the house, I guess, shahriya, gets Shahriya until they become a Marja. Right? And when they become a Marja, you know, until they didn't become a Marja, right, they used to get Shahriya from the like Maraja. Now when they become a Marja, now they have to give Shahriya. You know, because the Khums is coming to them now. See, until they were not Marja, the Khums was going to another Marja, and they would get Shahriya from him. When they become Marja, the Khums is coming to them, and they have to distribute the Shahriya now to the people.
Does this include the students that just like are freshmen that just enter, you know?
Of course, anyone who goes to the Hauza, even if you come to Orlando, you're giving a Shahriya. But if you come to Imam Ali's seminary in Orlando, you're given a Shahriya. That this is, you know, for your expenses to study. If you go to Qom, the same thing. Any house is the same thing. You don't pay anything. Right? Yes.
On the Pandavalai Taqeem, it is not, and to be clear, I think it was explained to me, I just want to make sure. It isn't necessary that it has to be from Iran. That the Walayat Faqih is chosen. If the Islamic Ummah, the Shia Ummah, grows transnational, meaning you go in and say, go to Iraq, Bahrain, Qatar, then you're, by definition, your Majlis-e Kubragan, the one that is overseeing and choosing, would therefore expand beyond the borders of that, and you'd have representatives from whether Iraq, you know, not, different places. Is that correct?
Okay. First of all, let me explain a little bit about Wilayat al-Faqih, you know, first of all, you know, for a lot of people who might not understand what it is, this and that, you know, listen, Wilayat al-Faqih is just logic, right? It's logic. It's like, you know, an equation, you know. You know, it's just a logical thing. Meaning, in the when the Imam is not here, who has the authority to make decisions over other? Does the alim make decisions for the jahil, or does the jahil make decisions for the alim? Right? You only have two options. Islam says wilayat or authority is for the alim, which is faqih. Right? Because Allah used the word faqih in the Quran. He says, وَلَيَتَفَقَّهُ فِي الدِّينِ, those who have fiqh in the deen. Right? So those who are faqih in the deen, who have deep understanding in the religion, so Allah used that term, and hence the wilayat is for the faqih in the ghaibat of the imam. Right? And you know, for those people, because of political reasons, this and that, they might say that we don't agree with the wilayat of faqih. They're saying that, okay, we don't agree with the wilayat of the alim, so the only other option is the wilayat of the jahil. So you're saying if the alim is not making the decision, then the jahil should make the decision. There's only two options here. Right? And hence, it is a logical thing. Anyone who denies it, you know, he's acting against logic. Now, when it comes down to the actual practical application of the authority, right, it isn't everywhere. Allah sometimes gave the wilayat without the criteria of knowledge, you know. For example, he gave the wilayat in the household to the man of the house. He says the final decision will be made by the man of the house. But he encouraged men to learn so that when they make decisions, it will be right. Right? And if you're ignorant, you still have authority, but if you make decisions, you're going to make a mess in your house. Right? This is your kingdom, your house is your kingdom, and you have authority from Allah. So now when Allah gave you the authority, then if you have the knowledge, you will see your kingdom will run fluently. But if you don't have the knowledge, you will destroy your kingdom. But you have wilayat, right? You know, from Allah. So in the ghaibat of the imam, the wilayat is with the alim, right? To rule, have authority, and have the authority to make decisions for the ummah. Now, wilayat al-faqih is different from mujtahid al-marja. It is different, my brothers. Marja is different, wilayat al-faqih is different. Right? You see, you are a person. Who are you in the audience? And me. We are a person. We have two sides to us. We are an individual at first. I'm an individual. I have my obligation before Allah as an individual. Those obligations are divided into wajib, haram, mustahab, makruh, and mubah. These things. So I need to know what is wajib, I need to know what is haram, I need to know what's this. For my individual obligation before Allah, I need to know the prayer, I need to know fasting, I need to know what Allah wants from me as an individual. So I go to a marja to seek guidance on what I should do as an individual. This is one side of us. Now all of us have a different side also. And that is me not being an individual, but being a part of an ummah. A member of the society that we live in. A part of an ummah. Allah also made us an ummah. He said, وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَاحِدًا. We have made you an ummah. We have made you a nation, a society of people. So we have social obligations also, social responsibilities also. Right? So, like, marja is, for example, one who says this is haram, this is wajib. This deals with the individual. My individual response to Allah. Now we need a leader for this group of people. Who is going to tell this group of people what this group needs to do, where this group needs to stand. Right? We need leadership for that also, for the group. And hence, there is that need for wilayat. That leadership, that authority, who's going to make decisions for this ummah. Us all together, you know. For example, my individual needs, I go to the marja. But for the social needs, I need a leader. We all need one leader. It cannot be two, it cannot be three, it cannot be four. It has to be one for the society. That's just logical. Every society knows that. America doesn't have two presidents. Right? America doesn't have two presidents, one who lives in the east wing of the White House and one west wing of the White House. You know? And whenever like we don't like him, we'll go to him. You know, it can't be. Right? Allah says about himself, he says, if there was any other God in the universe, there would be fasad and chaos. Right? For the universe, for the ummah, for the group of people, there has to be one leader who makes decisions. And obviously that leader is the imam of the time, but in his ghaibat, there has to be someone who leads, and the imam has to show us the way of how we choose that. Just like he chose a mujtahid, but a few more things he added. A few more conditions he gave in hadith. That other than the conditions of being a mujtahid, he also must have the ma'rifat of his zaman, of the time he lives in. Meaning that he should be smart enough to know what's going on in the world, who is the enemy, who is not the enemy, and what is the best way to live in this world. Meaning that he should have political insight, other than just having the knowledge. So any mujtahid who has that wisdom and political insight, then he should be that. If you look in Ziyarat-e Jamia of Imam Ali al-Hadi, you see that in Ziyarat-e Jamia, he describes the role of the Imam, and in describing that, he calls him Sasatul Ibad. Sasatul Ibad, Sasat from the word Siyasat. He said, you are the political leader of the people. Tell the Imam, you are the political leader of the people. You are the one who knows politics the most. You know? And hence this is a knowledge that the Imams gave to their students. To have that knowledge of politics. And hence, he who has the best insight into how to take the ummah from one stage to another, then we will, like for example, the Ahle Khubra, you know, as is the way that has been mentioned by the Imams and how it has evolved, will choose that person. Now, where should he be from, this and that? There's no criteria based on whether he's Iranian, Arab, Indian, Pakistani, Chinese, whatever. That's not the criteria. The only reason right now that you see Wilayat al-Faqih is in Iran is because Iran is the only Islamic state. Imam Khomeini revived the idea, the founder of the, like for example, this whole movement, and he revived the idea, and hence this idea, because he revived it, from him, his successor was Ayatollah Khamenei, and hence until now, he is still alive. Right? Where it goes in the future depends on which way the Islamic movement is headed. Which way the Islamic movement is headed, you will see that's where we will go from there. Right? But this is going ahead until the Imam comes back. This is established until the Imam will come back, and hence you will see that will... And I'll tell you why it's important. You see, why should we have a leader? Why should we have a leader, Historically first. In the past, we were an underground religion. Shia Islam was an underground religion, a basement religion. Who would dare to come out and say that you are a Shia? Right? You wouldn't dare do that. You would be hiding in your basement, you would all come together, and let's have a majlis, slowly. Don't make any noise. Neighbors will hear or they'll complain to the government or the ruler. Right? Only recently we came out of the basement and saw the sun. Right? We were like, wow, we can come out. Only recently, it's not been long that we were allowed to come out. Right? And you see, now that we came out, right, so this is something new for us. And hence we started to establish our communities. For hundreds of years we couldn't even establish a community. We didn't even have a masjid. We were being ruled by a Sunni majority that would not allow us to have a masjid. Right? And now that we got the opportunity to have our own places, to build our own communities, we started building them. It started in Iraq and Iran, they're spread out here and there, and slowly you see the communities established, people became Shia, and so it happened. So now, obviously, leadership was not an issue for the longest time. We are just trying to establish communities here and there, just, organize ourselves. And now we came to this point where now, we have the look of a nation now. We are looking like a nation, especially after the Islamic Revolution and the events that happened after that till now, the last 30 years. Really, it's so fast it's growing up that now we look like a nation. And hence, now, Allah, the blessing of Allah, that He provided us that leadership and that concept before the enemies could get together and attack us. This is Allah's blessing that He gave us a leadership before the enemies attacked us. If this onslaught was there before the leadership was established, we would be like sheep being hunted down, easy targets. But it's because of leadership that we are being mobilized and we are able to focus on important things.
Could there be a council of fuqaha where the leadership rests? If Majlis-e-Fuqahan cannot agree on one person as a leader,
you see what happens, right, is this. The Prophet, even when he sent two people out somewhere, he would make one of them the leader. Right? This is the way of the Prophet. One has to lead. One person. Right? That's the way he did it. If we want to follow the Sunnah of the Prophet, that's the way we do it. And you know what? Non-Muslims are following the Sunnah of the Prophet better than us. Right? That they give importance to one person actually making the executive decisions. But he's not doing the legislation. He's not making up rules. He's just implementing them. He's enforcing them. He's the executive branch. You cannot have two leaders in an executive branch. Right? See, if it were a legislative branch, then you have a group of people making legislation, right? But if it's an executive branch, then you can't have two, three people making decisions. They will never do anything right. They're always stalling. That's the reason, we have to have the faith and the system that the Imam gave us. He gave us a system. It might look, you know, the leader might look insignificant. Really. You know, Ayatollah Javadi Amali, you know, he explained this once, I remember. He said that, you know, the Imam, like for example, if you're saying, like when we say that this is the rule of Imam Ali, then Imam Ali's rule had two sides to it. One was the ruler, the hakim, and one was the kingdom, the hukumat. Right? The two sides. He said in Imam Ali's government, the hakim was masoom. The hukumat was not masoom. Hukumat is not masoom. Imam Ali's hukumat was not masoom. It wasn't infallible. The hukumat was made up of, sinful people. Hukumat is made up of people. And the people are sinful. The hakim was masoom. The ruler was masoom, but the people under him were not masoom. That's why they're running away with the money. Imam Ali's own appointed people, the one he appointed over other people, you know, to be governors and this and that, they are running away with the people's money. And Imam Ali is sending his force after them. And people are saying, look who you appointed. Yeah? So if the hukumat was masoom, this won't happen. Right? Imam Ali was masoom, the hukumat wasn't. Here, we're not saying that the hakim is masoom. The hakim is also not masoom, the hukumat is not masoom. But it's based on the same principles that Imam Ali taught. Right? To encourage Islam and to shun away kufr and shirk. It's based on that. Right? And hence, this is the way, you know, Islamic hukumat is formed. What is Islamic hukumat? See, let's say, you know, IEC, for example, inside, you know, and this is, you know, something that we all need to keep in mind. This is the house of Imam Zaman. This is his place.
Maulana, we have two questions on the sister's side. First question was, the parents are asking, if you have a 9-year-old, the kids who become baligh, how do you explain to them how to choose a marja on their own?
Okay.
Instead of following who their parents follow.
Well, no, the thing is that, you know, maybe 9-year-old might not be able to do that, right? One is being baligh, another thing is being mature. When you reach the age of maturity, that's when you actually are able to choose, you know, like for example, you know, to know who's right and wrong. Right, being baligh, you just need to be taught, okay, you know, for example, whoever the marja of the parents, they can say, okay, you know what, do this. You pray like this, you fast like this. As Maulana Ali Dada, as we said, that as long as they're praying and fasting according to the way the mujtahid says it, which is all the mujtahids say the same thing, right, then they're all right. They can choose a marja when they grow up, when they have the maturity to know who's right and wrong. Right? All right, inshallah. So I guess we have to stop over here because of the lack of time. We're going to start prayer.
Finish your thought about IEC.
Yeah, well, all I wanted to say is this, right? Just like any other center, right? This, you know, when you made the house, when Shias make a center, they say this is the place for Imam Zaman. This is, he owns this. When he comes back, he will take it. My friends, since we know that this is the house of Imam Zaman, that at least we should give that respect to the Imam by implementing his system in his house and not a system of kufr in his house. You know, we should have the wilayat of the alim here because that's what the Imam said, not democracy. Right? You don't bring democracy in the house of the Imam and insult him. And say that is your house, but we're going to practice kufr in your house. It's like having idols in the Kaaba. Right? Respect the Imam by doing what he says in this house. And hence, this becomes your Islamic government in the land of kufr. At least in these four walls which Imam owns, when you come here, you know that this is the Imam's rule. This is not Obama's rule. Obama doesn't rule here. He rules outside the door. Inside the door, Imam rules here. Imam is the ruler here, and we're going to follow the Imam here. Inshallah, with that thought, let's go in prayer, and inshallah, salawat.